Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a poetry reading co-sponsored by the Boston University Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning, College of General Studies, and Center for the Humanities. Our readers are American poet Phyllis Levin and Irish poet Peter MacDonald. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities Meg Tyler.
I'm going to introduce both poets tonight first, and then they will come up. Phyllis Levin will read first, and Peter MacDonald will read second. But I'm going to introduce Peter first here, because that's how I've written it, darn it. And I just can't mess with the order at this point. So Peter MacDonald was born and grew up in Belfast. He won the Newdigate Prize for Poetry and an Eric Gregory Award. He's a university teacher and currently Christopher Towers student and tutor in poetry in the English language at Christ Church, Oxford. He's a prominent critic of modern and contemporary poetry. He's published a book on Louis MacNeice, a study of Northern Irish poetry entitled Mistaken Identities, Poetry in Northern Ireland, and most recently, Serious Poetry, Form and Authority from Yeats to Hill. He's edited Louis MacNeice's selected plays and is also the editor of the forthcoming new edition of MacNeice's collected poems. He's at work on the Longman edition of the complete poems of W.B. Yeats. His books of poetry include Herne the Hunter, Collected Poems, Torchlight, The House of Clay, Pastorals, and a translation of the Homeric hymns, from which he read in Belfast when I was there a year and a half ago, and it was wonderful to hear him read. Of his poems, Michael Longley writes, "These poems, which with their gently syncopated lines may seem understated, register the uneasiness and the excitement of the buzzing world. They are, in the poet's own words, back roads to everywhere." Another poet whose prose on poetry has been equally important to me is Phyllis Levin, who's a poet, an essayist, and an editor. Her newest book, Mr. Memory and Other Poems, was selected by Library Journal as one of the top picks in poetry for spring 2016 and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Poetry. She is the author of four other collections, Temples and Fields, The After Image, Mercury, and May Day, and is the editor of the Penguin Book of the Sonnet, 500 years of a classic tradition in English. Her honors include the Poetry Society of America's Norma Farber First Book Award, a Fulbright Scholar Award to Slovenia, the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Scholarship, a Bogliasco Fellowship, and grants from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Of her poems, Tom Slay writes, "She never fans the air with some single faculty, but in every encounter, in every poem, the full force of all her faculties achieves a sacramental completeness of understanding." Her book on the sonnet tradition gave to me a companionable voice, as well as setting the bar high for lucid literary history and criticism. She calls it an anthology that is really an autobiography of the life of a literary form. She opened my ears to the exhausting possibilities of rhyme in what she calls the delicately calibrated world of the sonnet, and she hints at the form's tendency to implode in its solitary cell. Thankfully, there will be no implosions here tonight, but celebrations, constructions, and effusions. We are lucky to have these two gifted poet critics with us, both of whom are vigilant about what C.S. Lewis calls the ancient, fragile, and well-used, immensely potent instruments that words are. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Meg. It's an honor for me to be reading with Peter MacDonald and also to be reading in your company, because there are a number of people in the audience who are among the poets and scholars I respect and admire the most. So thank you so much for putting us together. Thank you. I'm going to read a few poems from May Day and then some poems from the new book, and then a few new poems. Acorn. Under his hat, many secrets. Asleep, keeping time. Soon it will tell almost everything if you wait long enough in the grass, in the snow, if you look, if you listen. And if you do nothing, it will be what it will be nevertheless. With a hat like that, you could walk the windiest hall of an endless wood as the worst and the best rain down out of nowhere. With a hat like that, you could hide the highest hope, the biggest fear, and appear once a year to disappear. Oh, where is the loom on which it is woven? How can a tomb too small for a petal carry the body of autumn in its hull? Cradle of greenest memory, kernel dreaming the weight of a starling, cupola cupping the fire of dawn, den of creation shedding itself again for a song. Oh, give me a room to keep a secret until the leaf is ready to be lit. And when it is time to go out into the cold, give me a hat like that. We've had so much extreme weather recently. This poem refers to an event that some of you may remember. It occurred the day after Christmas. It was the 26th of December in 2004. It was the Sumatra-Andaman earthquake. And the photographs on the cover of many newspapers were profoundly shocking. Some of you, if you saw those photographs, you wouldn't have forgotten them. This poem is in some way a response to that trauma. And like many things, it only could approach in miniature something so large. It's called Album. Why on earth does a postage stamp come to mind when I see those floating bodies? Immaculate faces of infants sleeping too deeply in the wake of the tsunami. Long ago, a flood overtook the basement, almost all the old books in ruins, leather bindings buckling, gilded edges fading, the marbling drifting away. From the wreckage, we pulled the stamp albums my father kept, and another that was mine, holding the countries I longed to visit, lozenges of color, names too fragrant to pronounce. Nations that are no more could slumber there, though swallowed or torn. Mountains, bridges, and flowers survived. The cover was stained, the pages dried, but one of the stamps had come undone, sliding from corners lovingly fastened. And now whole shorelines are sliding away, the book of the world so swollen it cannot close. My newest book, I like books that don't have sections, so sometimes collections of poetry do need sections. But in this book, rather than demarcate things with Roman or Arabic numbers, I used tanka and haiku to create the contours around different parts. The first poem in the book is a tanka, Fame. I will disappear into the sea and not be heard from. By moonlight, rise up galloping upon a blue horse born in my blood. Lenten song. That the dead are real to us cannot be denied. That the living are more real when they are dead terrifies. That the dead can rise as the living do is possible to surmise. but all the stars cannot come near all we meet in an eye. Flee from me, fear, as soot flies in a breeze. Do not burn or settle in my sight. I've tasted you long enough. Let me savor something otherwise. Who wakes beside me now suits my soul. So I turn to words, only to say he changes into his robe, rustles a page. He raises the lid of the piano to release what's born in its cage. If words come back to say they compromise or swear again they have died, there's no news in that, I reply. But a music without notes these notes comprise, still as spring beneath us lies, already something otherwise. I'm going to read also a poem that's very much tracing an arc of history from well before the Second World War, in fact, before the First World War, through to the present. And it's also a poem where the large is encountered through the miniature. It's called Demitasse. And the little epigraph is circa 1887, which is the date when this little demitasse was made. Demitasse. You evaded the firestorm, reaching the shore of the New World long before. So nothing to speak of has shaken you more than the rage in my father's voice, or my brother's infant fist shattering a pane of the china closet, leaving you unharmed, the shards swept away, the glass replaced in a day. Through it all, you never were lifted, never filled, until at the close of the century I asked for you. A door opened. You were offered without a pang, without a story. No shape have I beheld as finely wrought. But are you the craft of a human hand or a portal to splendor? Burnt umber glazes my espresso. I'm adrift yet home, my lip touching yours, touching gold. And when I'm done, I peer over the brim to find a faded corona within. Your fluted pedestal gives you balance. You contain an eternity of sighs. At the bottom, where you taper and the dregs settle, thick enough to muffle any cry, a blossom abides in the center. Even when you are empty, something is there. Sometimes I study the scallops of your body, slipping my fingers along your contours, curious about your lineage, wondering who else marveled at your lightness, your near transparency, turning you over then to see the mark of your maker, a blue lamb standing by a gilded rose, its feet resting on a slender line, a single brush stroke saying, this is the earth that will hold whatever dwells here. This the border dividing above from below. And under this line, in a curse of deliberate and free, run the letters telling where you became what you are. You were born in a lull called peace, in a kiln in Meissen, from a mound of clay in the river's mossy marsh. You were reborn in Dresden, adorned by a master painter of flowers that bloom in fire. You arrived in a steamer trunk in New York Harbor. You need no saucer, have no mate. I will look after you and pass you on, hoping you stay for the last drop of the last day, the future for which you were made. One of the ways of testing porcelain is to drop it and it bounces. It doesn't break if it's really good porcelain, and it's fired at such an extraordinary heat. And this little thing, I still drink my espresso out of, and it's
it really is almost transparent, and it's so light, you feel like you're going to fall over. You know how that is when you lift something and you think it'll be a little heavier, and you're like... To an ash on a crackling log. Little bat, gray rose, you quicken now, a pulse, a bloom, curling in on yourself embryonically and in a breath, spinning up the flue, a gust away from floating free into a cloud whose ions hold eons of lovers at play, gazing upon earth as if falling were a myth, as if they weren't a breath away from spinning, dear dervish, like you. On either side of the word lie, the title of this poem segues into the poem itself. On either side of the word lie, the letters that must be taken away to find the word nestled inside or not yet born. Removing those letters, deciding how many, which ones, is a science that resembles forgetting, dismemberment in the service of song. Finally, a new word rises from its shell, and if it cannot rise, it calls out, saying, it's time to be said, I've been here all along. But you were reading without speaking, seeking without seeing. A syllable alone is a seed of light. Kettle. Flame under the bubbling water. Blue flame. Water ready for tea. Amber infusion soon to be seeping. Leaves about to uncurl. Here is a tin, a spoon, a cup, an open teapot saying, nobody else but me to nobody else but you. Awaken. Pour. What are you waiting for? I'm sure... Not only am I not the only one, but I'm probably in the majority of having an emotional response to rain. I think rain does something to all of us in different ways, but it also connects us all because we have a shared experience. And this poem, I suppose, grows out of that. The poem is entitled An Anthology of Rain. For this, you may see no need. You may think my aim dead set on something devoid of conceivable value, an anthology of rain, a collection of voices telling someone somewhere what it means to follow a drop traveling to its final place of rest. But do consider this request. If you have pressed your nose of any shape against a window, odor of metal faint, persistent, while a storm cast its cloak over the shoulder of every cloud in sight. You are free to say whatever crosses your mind when you look at the face of time in the passing of one drop gathering speed, one drop chasing another, racing to reach a fork in the path, lingering before making a detour to join another, fattening on the way until entering a rivulet, running to the sill. So please accept this invitation. You are welcome to submit. There is no limit to its limit. Even the instructions are a breeze. As long as you include nothing about yourself except your name. Your address remains unnecessary, for the rain will find you. If you receive it, it receives you. Whether or not you contribute, a volume is sent. And when you lift the collection, you may hear by opening anywhere a drop and its story reappear as air turns to water, water to air. I think I'll close with one poem. This is, Carl is in the audience, and I know you were living in Rome, and this poem grows out of having lived in Rome for a year. You lived there longer, but I always find it takes a long time to metabolize travel. For it to be inside of oneself rather than outside. And this poem was written quite recently, though it does directly grow from my experience living in Rome. I was in Italy from January 2000 through the end of January 2001. And I'll never forget being at a New Year's party in New York, January 2000, and people had these sparklers, and everybody was so filled with hope. And one of my friends was making a two with the zeros, and I saw a swan. The two looked like a swan in profile, and the zeros looked like the three eggs that were going to hatch. It was a weird moment, and it always stayed with me as this image of hope. This isn't in the poem. That's probably a poem that hasn't been written yet. But I'm bringing it up because it's almost like a neon dream that's behind the poem. And the poem is called Duel of Roses, not Duel, D-U-E-L, Duel. Oh, the only reference, some of you probably have been to Rome and you know, or you've seen Tosca, and you know the Sant'Angelo, you know the structure, the physical structure itself, which it, you know, was associated originally with Hadrian. But you also, some of you would know the Pont Sant'Angelo, the bridge, which is a pedestrian bridge. So this poem refers to Sant'Angelo and means both. Both do figure in. And Bernini was hired by the Pope to design a series of angels representing the Passion, the different instruments of the Passion. He only finished a few of them, and the one that the Pope liked the most he took for himself, and so it's not on the bridge. But the project was finished, and the drawings of Bernini were followed. And I do refer to one of those angels. Duel of Roses. Once in the streets of Rome, I engaged in a duel of roses, on guard, with Veronica Piracini, painter of day glow darkness, who would hold her mama's giant antique grater between her knees, a Madonna in a fury, working that contraption to build a cloud of cheese as she made a midnight spaghetti alla carbonara for her and me. She talked a mile a minute, a kilometer, should I say, peppering her Italian with over the top, the only expression in English she ever used, a subtitle for the comedy of her life, while I, drunk on an excess of vowels, held my tongue lest she scrape her skin or fail to check the boiling water of a bout of mutual laughter were to begin. What was the spur of this humor? Nothing less than the trouble her beauty got her in. One adventure after another, ending in a disastrous flourishes of gallantry followed by bad behavior. How did we get those flowers? We found a fresh bouquet. Someone must have flung, who knows why, over the rail of a cafe we would soon be strolling by. Rose in hand, I raised my arm to the sky. On guard, and she, rose in hand, raised hers. From the outside, how did our duel appear? We didn't care. We upheld our honor, defending our right to be there no matter the hour. Late it was when we parried on the bridge where a pope found refuge, crossing where the stems of our roses crossed. I can still hear the horns blow in the shadow of Sant'Angelo. Bernini's angels in a row, one holding Veronica's veil, and a boy calling out to Veronica, che bella, Marilyn Monroe, from a winged scooter on the go. In the year of the great jubilee, at the close of the last century, 2000 anno domini, zeros lining up anew, a trail of pilgrims murmuring, jostling, streaming through. Thank you.
Thank you for that. It's very hard to read your own poems when you're turning over the wonderful poems you've just heard in your mind. I suppose there's the comfort that since I have a printed text, I won't be imitating what I've just admired, so we'll be okay. I'm going to start with a poem about one of those helium balloons with novelty shapes and designs that children like and that I'm sure the environment doesn't like. You know, so consider this a poem of guilt. Because it's a poem in two parts about one such balloon in the shape of a cheetah. The poem is called The Cheetah. Cat-shaped, but bigger than a cat. On its long string, the toy balloon rose and wandered while you sat tethering it this afternoon to your right hand, correcting me when I misread its spots and called the cheetah a leopard. Your free hand pointed where the creature stalled and started on its leash. You shaped its profile for me in the air as you jumped to your feet, escaped our skyless room, and there you were outside. And I was with you, saying not to let go, not to let go. For fear the cheetah, toppling, swaying, would leave us standing far below and helpless. But you laughed and said that was the whole idea. Then stretched one arm up over your head with all the cheetah's lift between two fingers, and you opened them, letting it jump high in the wind, the long string trailing, helium so light. Once it was unentwined, that the balloon shot upwards, flew across the houses, over town, but kept, till it was out of view, the cat shape of its yellow brown. You were delighted, and we watched until the drifting ship was gone entirely, and the whole sky matched itself in patchy blue again. I saw myself drawing a line in the air around some dangerous, fast-moving predator of mine that I enclosed and filled with gas to set it loose into the day. What I held or was holding to could take itself up and away, and all there was for me to do was let it go. I almost felt the string rise and unravel through my fingers, like someone who knew that he would give up everything he had and could have, everything, to stand here for these minutes, to search in the empty sky with you. And I could sense the shiny pelt of that wild animal ascend out of my reach for good, to live without us at the cold, far end of the harm we do, the hurt we give, and join the cheetah, stalking space, not to be ours again, to be a lost shape in some open place, high up. And that's the whole idea. I'd like to read I suppose you'd call it a story poem, or a poem with a story. I wonder, could I date this incident? I would date this to approximately 1970, when I, believe it or not, I was still very, very small in 1970. But it relates to a furniture or furnishings shop where my mother worked. In a part of Belfast, which I'll refer to in this poem, called the Craigie Road, very uninteresting part of Belfast. But the owner of the shop, I am, in retrospect, in this poem, turning into a kind of Belfast Falstaff. Actually, most men in Belfast are Falstaffian. I'm fighting it. All right, I'm fighting it. The story, though, is told for reasons that I could go into, but you probably wouldn't thank me if I did. It's told in a particular verse form of Ottava Rima, the eight-line stanza of many, many poets, good and bad. It's the shopkeeper in this poem, by the way, attempts a sort of mild form of unsuccessful sexual assault by means of pheasants. And it's not every day that you can say that. The poem's called A Brace. In from the Craigie Road, through the showroom, it's Roald Axminster and new Parker Knoll, full of himself and beaming like a bridegroom up the aisle, with a whiskey pitch and roll back from the pub, straight into the lit gloom of my mother's back office cubbyhole, walked leahy, brandishing like contraband, two pheasants that he swung from either hand. A cock pheasant and hen pheasant, each one with its neck stretched down from a tiny head and its body barely ruffled from the gun. The male's green balaclava splashed with red around each eye and long feathers, half done up and half undone, with the wingtips spread. The female, with her dead shape, duller brown and buxom, a barred tail stiff and pointed down. Leahy's big frame blocked the whole office door when he came on in proudly, with the brace of birds all mischief and jovial uproar, dangling their bodies in my mother's face, with "there you are, you girl," ready to pour them both into her lap and take his place as the bringer in of luxury and delight or some abundant spirit of the night. His own body weighed down and flushed, one bead of sweat on the red brow, its hot flesh tones glowing in from the cold. He took the lead that evening between ledgers and telephones because he had to, or the simple need aching and echoing in hollow bones made him, or his good nature, or the rife sorrows and wants that filled this part of life. High spirits and abiding anguish, time passing through blood as it forces a rift between the soul and flesh. His stratagem, if it was that, his spur-of-the-moment gift, was doomed. Two birds, she sobbed at home, and them with the heads and feathers still on them. She'd lift her fearful face to look me in the eye. Dead birds, but why would Leahy do that? Why? He hadn't known how much she was afraid of feathered things until he saw her tears that night, the angry panic as she made her exit past him, speechless, through the chairs and sofas, rugs and tables where he stayed alone. Poor Robert Leahy, dead these years, the life in him so strong, but even then heavy, between the cock pheasant and hen. My last book, Her and the Hunter, is a book. It isn't quite with two parts, it's with two sides, which regard one another as though in a slightly distorting mirror, so that the forms of the poems in the first half of the book are mirrored, but not quite exactly mirrored, by the poems in the same order in the second half of the book. You get the idea. Which means that there is a 12-sonnet sequence in the first half and a 12-sonnet sequence in the second. In the first half, it's a Petrarchan sequence. In the second half, a Shakespearean one. That's all to explain. I'm just going to read one sonnet, by the way. Don't worry. And it is one of those Petrarchan sonnets. From the sequence which is actually called Her and the Hunter. To make life even more complicated for me, you and everybody else, this sequence is actually a catalogue of trees as well. People have been doing catalogues of trees for centuries, so I thought I really had better. And this sonnet is the Hawthorn section. Hawthorn to heal the heart. Beneath an arc of blossom, fizzing as it jumps and jigs with every gust, how many jaggy sprigs would you need to cut away from leaves and bark for that medicine to work? I see a mark on each leg, where the sharp cord snaps and digs at your skin, and lines etched there, like twigs that touch each other gently in the dark. Thorn runs under the tiny flowers and faces upwards beneath them, where you wouldn't see as you close a hand. Then, in a dozen places, it leaves its little wounds, intricately arranged in salmon and black corsetry, with hooks and eyes and buttons and tight laces. I'm going to read another poem from Hearn, which is the only poem I've ever written or will ever write on the subject of theology. Theology is a very difficult thing. I'm frankly not bright enough to understand most theology, but I found a particularly recalcitrant and weird bit of theology to write about, which was the arguments that were held over centuries and centuries ago over the single or the dual nature of Christ. These being vicious arguments that could easily get you done away with if you got your plural in the wrong place, you know. But it's based on a trip I made a long time ago to Lebanon, and where the cedar tree is a national symbol and is much protected. And visiting one of these protected groves. I think the rest of it will explain itself. And please don't ask me to explain the theology afterwards, because I can't. But that's because I'm much, much stupider now than when I wrote the poem. At the time I wrote this, I should sign something, shouldn't I? At the time I wrote this poem, I knew what it meant. Lebanon. High up in the dead cedar, someone has carved a figure of Jesus stretched over the cross. His polished face, angular and half-starved, faces downwards, like that of a man diving in free fall to the ground, ready to toss his life away and then see death arriving, bang on time, almost already there, upwards towards him, through breathtaking air. What God would ever want this for himself? If once he looked out forwards, he would see a line of mountains, the snowed-over shelf of Mount Lebanon, the Kadisha Valley stretched underneath it, and even each tree around him adding to the cedar tally one. But he looks down, and is looking still down to the earth with a singular will. Living a second, discontinuous life, the tour guide talks to us about the war, phalanges, sects, and the contours of strife that make a map of his imagination, how close he came, or came at least not far from death, when a hand grenade's conflagration caught him out of nowhere on the left side. A friend next to him and a stranger died. He remembers how the air was sucked away all in an instant, how the blast was not noise, but a silence opening. The spray of soil and stones and blood together going in the wrong direction, and a vacuum hot and fast pulling him inwards, a force growing enormous in a second. Then the fear just after, as they dragged his body clear. And now the same man stands here, fit and whole, below this Jesus of the Maronites. His talk of trees and the cedar patrol that guards year-round the few of them still standing, the dangers of dry summers and cold nights, and names of birds here flying off or landing close to their hidden nests, somewhere above all of our heads in the protected grove. What we might say, standing on his deaf side, is lost, but he laughs and nods anyway. How much is spoken, how much more implied about things by the people who have seen them, hangs like a question, balancing today in two natures with the one will between them. Even the thin air at this altitude smells of needles and undecaying wood. I have a couple of poems I want to finish with. They both need a little bit of explanation, maybe. Both from Hearn. The first of them is the match for that poem about the strange use of pheasants I read you earlier. That is, it's a formal match for it. The same length, the same stanza form. But it's got other things to do as well. It has an epigraph, which I always read just because I think the epigraph is brilliantly weird. It's drawn from the works of W.B. Yeats. I think he wrote it in about 1925. And it is this. I saw a man, Yeats writes, I saw a man at Ross's Point carrying two salmon. One man with two souls, I said, and added, oh no, two people with one soul. I remember the mystical painter Horton, whose work had little of his personal charm and real strangeness, writing me these words, I met your beloved in Russell Square, and she was weeping, by which he meant that he had seen a vision of my neglected soul. So that's the source of the epigraph for this poem. The poem itself, I'll add, was written partly in response to a poem by Seamus Heaney, and was for Seamus in some ways. And it took on the character, I suppose, of an elegy for Seamus a bit after it was written, when Seamus died. Funnily enough, I miss Seamus more as every year passes. It's one of those losses that gets worse. Anyway, here's the poem. It's called Two Salmon. I met your beloved in Russell Square, and she was weeping. Their dead weights balance him. Suspending one on either side, he carries down the fish he must have killed out on the salmon run, here where the river slows to water wash and salt and a lazy tide. So in the sun they glitter from a distance, and they flash like things that could be animate and raw, each with its whole weight taken on the jaw. Two salmon closer up, and not alive in their suits of miraculous chainmail fitted like skin, not enough to survive out in the parched and dazzling, unreal element of noise and wind. They arrive with blood flecks on the white and pewter scales along their bellies, each one the same size, these fish with their unclosable dead eyes. I nod to them, smile. It's as if what swings so heavily from each arm were a new option, a way of going about things. For a moment, anyhow, the fish are two lives, and he has his choice of them. He brings one and the other steadily into the world with its drizzle of light, its poles upright between sandbanks and sea, two souls. I look and look. Eventually he's gone. And maybe all of this was wrong, in fact. Remember how two bodies can have one soul between them, with that soul intact through all the very worst that can be done or said? They swim against a cataract over and over, light sheathing them from above, two bodies with one single life to prove. Know all the worst and see the worst thing whole. One life neglected by you, or betrayed somewhere beyond its own help or control, exposed and shivering and all afraid. Walk in the streets and see a crying soul that wants this body and another made. Look at it without sympathy or surprise. Look at it with your sore, wide-open eyes. You, meaning me, because of my own dread of open gills, fish scales, and the lithe, shine overpacked muscle when it's dried and dead. The salmon and the fisherman combine remorselessly in my remorseful head to plead and punish. Again and again they find me, and I find them when we go looking and looking. There is nothing to know. Well, I'm going to wind up with a gentler poem, which is also the last poem in Herne the Hunter, which I've not read before in public. And it's going to be a tough one for me to read in public now. My mother died this summer, and in her later years, like many people of her age, of course, she had terrible trouble with vision and other ancillary horrors of old age, such as raging tinnitus. While she still had a little vision, one of the last things she wanted to do was read through again my father's love letters to her, which I was able to find and give her. They now repose in my attic, and I haven't read them and can't read them. But this poem is around and about that. It's written in 12-line stanzas, and there are no rhymes within the stanzas, but the words rhyme from stanza to stanza. So it all comes right in the end. I'll finish with this. Its name is the Irish phrase Chéir na nóg, which will be explained in the course of the poem. This winter, you read all his letters again, brought out one by one from the chocolate box where you let them keep, bundled by the year. Holding them to the best light you could find, you tried to make each line come into line. For now that you see only the edges of things, it takes long work to settle and unbend words where they ravel and fray, then convert them to sense, like a scholar in old age matching the pieces. But you managed it, helped by remembering what you once read. Now you are reading it for the last time. Do people write love letters anymore? Messages, or whatever it is they send, short words and tiny pictures gone in flocks past fetching back, never put on a page, are harder to remember, aren't the same. He wrote these words when he was in his prime, and in the daylight your sore patience brings his voice home, back from somewhere near the start. Already you know every word that's said, for nothing here is new. He's right as rain, as if he'd see you later in the week, each time another blurry line comes clear. And there you are now, where the seagull's wings clear out the sky, far up, and the whole shore is visible, bright as noon. Every bit a real place where he is, and you with him. The wave's so big, you have to raise his head closer to yours before one word is plain. So loud now, that no matter how alert you are, you might as well resort to mime to overcome the water's rush and rage. I needn't ask you what you're doing here, for this is where everything washes clean away from your eyes as they go more blind. The door's closed, where someone knocks and knocks. They can wait there all morning, you don't mind. No reason why you shouldn't just remain here, where the ground is lit up like a stage for miles, then miles on miles, with a light heart, so light it's almost weightless. You might hit the proper name for this wide-open place, if ever you had named it. The waves pour over its moving sand that never changes. In the Irish, that neither of us can speak, it is Chernanog, the land of youth, and where nothing goes far or ever comes to an end. I see it as if the thin bars of a cage laid a grid across that sky and small rain was changing the light, but it keeps its shine enough to make my eyes sore. When I hear you say deliberately, with your voice weak, how well you loved him, everything arranges itself for me wherever it might fit. I loved badly, hurt others, and brought hurt on my own head, but you couldn't see my face even if I said so, or if I could send word of it to your ears through the great roar where only voices whisper and blood sings. Nobody there knows they've been left behind, or that we might be looking, listening. As a gull takes off with something in its beak, the clouds high up demolish and restore themselves, raked by the same sun, and the rocks hold their colours. Now we begin to gauge everybody's look. The last of the race, we are the simplest shapes that float and flit unnoticed at the edge of things, and then go away from the landmarks and the signs we knew, and they know. With faces that smart where a salt showery breeze picks up and stings. Thanks very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a poetry reading by American poet Phyllis Levin and Irish poet Peter MacDonald. The event was co-sponsored by the Boston University Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning, College of General Studies, and the Center for the Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.